If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets Live. My name is Paul Hill, and I'm delighted again to be able to speak to equity analyst and stock markets commentator Paul Scott to talk all things small cap. So welcome, Paul.
Thanks, Paul. Hello, everyone at home. Good to be back.
Yeah. Yeah, well, last week you were absolutely spot on. We've had a deluge of Christmas trading updates, particularly from the sort of the retailers and some of the supermarkets, Next and Greggs, Tesco's, M&S and Sainsbury's, etc. But just big picture, what's the sort of health of the consumer like from those sort of big sort of like, you know, bellwether stocks? And likewise, what do you think? So you look at sort of like the retailers as a lock, stock and barrel sort of stuff?
Well, I thought most of the updates from the big ones, as you've said, I think there'd be five, haven't there? I thought they were okay. I mean, what were people expecting, given that we know that the macro position is quite soft? But there were some really astonishing sell-offs, despite what I thought were reasonably reassuring updates. So, yeah, I'm very surprised at the stock market reaction, but I think it is throwing up two in particular I see as buying opportunities now.
Mm. And why do you think that was that sell-off? Was it because they ran up quite hard into Christmas and then they've just really sort of like, is that classic sort of like sell on the news?
I don't know, Paul. I mean, the trouble is nobody fills in a form to say why they're selling, are they? I think a lot of it's driven by traders, isn't it? I mean, say with M&S, it's the shares have done fantastically well. It's a really good multi-year turnaround. But I think in particular, the outlook comments were too vague with a number of them, including Marks and Spencer. But actually, if you go through it again on the second or third reading, you think to yourself, well, this is all right. But it's sold off from nearly £4 to, and it's down again now to only about £3.40. So It's on a PE of about 10 forward PE for a company that's on, and I don't have a position in any of these, so I'm not talking my own book. I think M&S at £3.50-ish or below is worth considering anyway as a possible entry point, because the food like-for-likes were amazing. I think they were up 9%, and that makes up 2/3 of M&S's total sales. Clothing and other was only up about 2%, but I didn't see anything bad in that update. How about you? I mean, are you seeing something I'm not?
No, I mean, I just thought sort of like overall the picture was of a fairly healthy consumer, actually. Yeah. I mean, when you consider how much sort of purchasing power, I mean, Tesco's in itself has got sort of 28% market share of the grocers. And on that basis, they were all talking the same sort of thing. Actually, it's continuation. We've had a good Christmas and yes. We don't see any major problems. We're going to absorb the cost increases from the NI increase in April. So overall, I thought the consumer was holding up pretty well.
I agree. And Tesco, as you say, I mean, these things contain a lot of granular detail, which I'm personally, I don't want to see. I tend to just go for the outlook section and say, well, what are they guiding up or down? And Tesco said no change to guidance for the current financial year. So that's fine, I think, given how tough macro is, that's good. And I think M&S dodged that, and I can't remember exactly. And Sainsbury's I haven't actually looked at yet, but it's the shares were only down 3%, which says to me they've probably traded well over Christmas. Have you looked at Sainsbury's, Paul? That was today.
No, I haven't actually. No, no. I mean, I know they've got a pretty strong balance sheet. They own quite a lot of their properties. I think the food business is doing reasonably well. It's the Argus stores which are not great. I don't think that likes in those areas. But I didn't really look at it in sort of great detail. Just turning
sorry, Paul. Can I just quickly mention B&M stores as well? BME. Now, this one again, I've got down as a potential buying opportunity because that sold off a lot. On an update that actually was overall in line. But people seem to latch on to the fact that Q4 sales like for like had gone slightly negative. But actually, if you read the whole announcement, it says that margins were strong. Therefore, overall, its profit was at least in line, I think they said. So a lot of analysts only look at like for like sales and they don't really understand that actually it's gross margins that probably have more effect on the bottom line than sales growth does. So I think BME, it dropped to £3, I think it was. And I said at that level, this thing I think is oversold. And it has bounced slightly to about £3.12. But if I had any spare cash, I'd probably buy a few of BME. I mean, it's a great business, amazing business. Look at the long-term history of it. It's incredible.
Well, I would highlight to investors, I mean, I've known Paul for at least 20 years ago. And Paul is the best retail analyst.
You are by a mile.
Having had that experience in the trade. Anyway, if he says those sort of things, then you should at least listen to him.
I'm out of date though, Paul, because my retail FD experience predates the internet. Right. Yes, I am that old.
Well, I'm the same age, but I'm at the other end. I'm absolutely rubbish at the consumer and retail. So I'm deferring to your advice. Well, not advice, your ideas. Now, just turning to another subject, we've had long-term yields, bond yields going up everywhere, essentially. First of all, what's causing it? And secondly, is it going to be a problem?
Well, this is obviously the hot topic at the moment that everyone's talking about. And I find generally these conversations date very badly. You know, within a few weeks, it will either become a catastrophe or got forgotten about. But so keeping it brief, I mean, as I demonstrated with some figures in my reports this week, this is a global phenomenon. Yes, UK bond yields, government bond yields are higher than the Eurozone, but they have been for a long time. In the last month, the bond yields, government bond yields in America and most Eurozone countries have risen almost exactly the same amount as UK ones have. So this is an international problem. And if you look at American finance websites, they're not talking about the UK at all. They're talking about, you know, higher inflation expectations, higher long-term interest expectations, Trump's policies quite possibly being inflationary with the import tariffs. So this is absolutely not a UK-specific problem, but our media is very parochial. I'm not saying that the government here has handled things well, because obviously their hikes in employers' NI stokes inflation, doesn't it? So they've made a lot of mistakes. There's no doubt about that, which is probably worse than things a bit. But I personally, I don't see this as anything even vaguely comparable to the Truss meltdown. But are you equally sanguine, Paul, or are you more dramatic?
Well, I think the bond market has actually sniffed out what's going to happen next year, because as soon as Trump won the election, he's obviously won the White House on the basis he's going to sort of tariff everybody. And what that means is that the bond market has sniffed out next year when he starts slapping these charges on likes of, you know, Canada, Mexico, China, and even sort of like arbitrarily in places like Europe, then we're going to get a lot of retaliation. And I think what the bond market's saying everywhere is actually we're going to have higher inflation. And that will only sort of transpire in the numbers once he's actually implemented it, which will be sort of like quarter 3, quarter 4, because he can't do it immediately. He can say what he's doing, but he can't do it immediately. But the point is, the bond markets work off expectations. Yeah. And so I think what you've started to see is that the future expectations for inflation have started to increase, which means that the bond market is expecting most central banks to hold off the cuts that they were previously expecting. Yes. So for instance, before Trump came in, the US was expecting 4 rate cuts. And now actually, I think there's only 1, which is coming in June. So
that's interesting. Thank you. I haven't picked up on that. Yeah.
And likewise with the UK, I think we're only expecting one now this year. When you put all that together, what it says is that the hope that the bond market that we're going to see falling interest rates this year means that it isn't going to happen, and therefore at the long end of the curve has started to move up, because it's going to be, you know, not just because of that but also actually because it might, you know, Trump is going to run a 7 or 8% fiscal deficit in his budget, and in the UK we're going to run, Rachel Reeves is going to run about 5%. So the term premium on the yield is actually increasing as well. So all in all, putting it all together, what that means is that we've probably fully reflected now the higher inflation expectations and the term premium in it. I'm hoping we have anyway.
Yeah, well, that's really good background, Paul, because I haven't had a huge amount of time to spend on this because I've been so busy with stocks this week. But I mean, it was only, 2 weeks ago that I remember reporting on an article, a survey of economists that Times published, saying the consensus was between 3 and 4 interest rate cuts of 0.25% each in the UK. Here we are 2 weeks later and you're saying it's gone down to 1.
So yes,
it just shows, doesn't it? You can't rely on any of these forecasts, even over a 2-week period.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, we'll find out what's going to happen. We'll find out on the 21st of January, which is only about 2 weeks' time. So that'll be a big day.
It's amazing how quickly things change, isn't it? It really is astonishing. Yeah. It seems to me more like a reset to a more realistic expectations, which probably, to my mind, my hunch only, is this is not a time to just run away and hide. You know, it's probably just been a sharp reset, and then things probably stabilize at the new level, maybe. Do you see it that way, Paul?
Yeah, I do. And if we get into trouble, I think there are other levers they could pull, isn't it? I mean, for instance, Trump will probably, if he gets desperate, will sack Jerome Powell at the Federal Reserve and then put some of his own, you know, stooge in there. And in fact, I think Jerome Powell's, his term's coming up I think it's May 26 or February 26. So it's only another 12 months anyway.
But he said, hasn't he, that Trump doesn't have the authority to sack him. But
he does, actually.
Oh, does he? Oh,
he does. Yeah, no, he does have the authority. He appoints the Federal Reserve guy. Agreed by two Senate guys in Congress. But no, he can absolutely sack him. But that just wouldn't look good.
No, well, I mean, Trump doesn't care about that, does he? I mean, my hunch is we're going to go back to QE. Led by America, and much lower interest rates, enormous economic stimulus, which, of course, if I'm right, would be a huge stimulus for equity markets and bond valuations. So I just thought I'd throw that grenade out there for people to think about. Everyone says to me, "Nah, it's a ridiculous idea," but I don't see how governments can afford the normalized interest rates on the level of debt to GDP they've got.
No, you're right. And also, you know, that would certainly sort of like reverse the strong dollar at the moment, wouldn't it? Because if you started pushing the button on the QE, then that's going to weaken the dollar, maybe, which is probably artificially priced.
Last time we did it, you know, it was done widely, wasn't it, around the world over many, many years in the zero interest rate thing from 2008 to 2022. None of the currencies really devalued against each other because they were all doing QE simultaneously. So that, I think, is an interesting angle on it as well. I mean, if the UK just announced, right, we're going to print £1 trillion of the new money, you know, sterling would drop 80% and we'd have hyperinflation. But if the US does it, we can then follow, I think.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe you're right. Yeah. But just one thing also, with this volatility, just for sort of like, you know, investors to highlight, stocks that potentially could benefit in these financial times with increasing, fast fluctuating bond yields, for instance, the interest rate traders, the interdealer brokers, the likes of TPI Cap, CMCX.
They've come down a lot. They've come down to about £2.40 CMC markets. Looking attractive again, that one.
And also, you know, the payments got, you know, so not. I do own it, obviously, and I talked about it last week, but Argentex on the Forex could do quite well, given the fluctuation in trading. And I did notice
That's perked up this week, hasn't it? I don't know. Do you know why? One of the readers was asking me and I didn't know.
Yeah, well, it's jumped 10% today, Argentex, and that's because it looks as though a big stock overhang has disappeared.
Okay.
That's just for everybody. That's a ticker AGFX, and Paul ran a competition for 2025 as a one-shot sort of like it. What your favourite stock? And I plumped for this one, and it's
great.
I've got a bit of a head start, which is nice.
Yeah, great stuff. Wait, well, I think you're flagging behind the reader who picked Victoria. I think that's I think that's up over 100% year to date.
Yeah. Are there any stocks and shares that you have bought and sold this week at all, Paul?
No, I'm still on margin call on my little trading account, not by much, so I haven't got any capacity. I would have liked to have picked up a few M&S and BME if I had a choice. Actually, in my SIP, my ungeared account, I like to just dabble with a few minnows in there. I did buy some S247 Smart Tech. I don't know if you've looked at that.
Oh, okay, yes, I know, cybersecurity guys.
Cybersecurity thing. It looks very, very cheap, only about 10 million market cap. Now, my new colleague, Dave Wild, he's my co-writer on my Substack. He wrote a section about it, and I don't really know anything about the company. And I thought, well, that looks interesting. I'll just pick up a few. So I haven't really properly researched it. It's just a punt, but I thought it looked okay. So, yeah.
What's it trading on, the PE-wise? Do you know?
No idea.
Okay, so you bought some, right? Okay, got it.
We all like to have occasional little punt, don't we? Just with single digits of our portfolio.
Yeah. Okay. One of your bigger stocks, though, had news this week. Interseed. Just want to give people a quick update on how you're seeing that.
Yeah. Very much like it. It's a multi-year hold, sensible hold for me. This one is not a punt. I've been on it since I met the new CEO. Well, no, he's been there about 5 or 6 years now, Klaus van der Leest. And he immediately struck me when I met him at what was at the time FinCap's, now Cavendish's, office. And I had a small group of private investors had a meeting with him. And we just came away thinking, this guy is going to turn this thing around. And he has done. He's done a great job. And now they're winning more contracts. It does cyber... security, online credentials management. We've talked about this quite a lot in the past. Yeah. I think it's a client list to die for, including lots of US federal agencies, the big ones, but it's now spreading its wings and starting to win contracts in the Middle East and in the Far East through systems integrator partners. And that, I think, could open up a lot of interesting things there. It's not cheap. You have to pay quite a high PE of approaching 40, I think, forward PE. But PE is not how you value growth companies, is it? Definitely not. No. And again, we've covered that a lot before. But I'm very keen on Interseed. It's just for me a sort of coffee can stock that I've just tucked away and forget about. And yeah, it put only a modest beat against forecasts, but Cavendish upped the forecasts a bit. I'm hoping they're holding a bit back and that there could well be another beat by the March year end, I think. But it kind of needs that, because when you've got a stock that's highly valued, it's no good just putting out prudent forecasts and then only saying we're broadly in line. That's not good enough for a highly rated stock, is it? But yeah, Interseed, it was a bit slow in coming out with the ahead of expectations update, but we got it this week, so I'm very relieved about that.
What's a coffee can stock, by the way?
Oh, it's that book. That bloody book. Cost me a fortune. It said just buy and hold forever.
Is it a coffee can?
Yeah, okay. So of course, when all the small caps were collapsing in 2022, I was going, no, I'm not going to sell. They're in my coffee can. I'm a long-term holder.
Oh, I love it.
It was a total disaster. So, yeah.
Okay, well, I'm gonna add a few of my stocks into that coffee can. Okay, yeah. If anybody wants to ask Paul any questions, please put them in the chat bot and I'll read them out. We've got one from a new person in the audience, Eddie Boots. He's asking about what's going to reverse the downtrend at 4 Imprint, which I think is the celebrations sort of like business, isn't it?
It's promotional products.
Promotional products, that's it, yes.
Yeah, almost entirely North American business.
Yeah.
Amazing long-term multi-bagger. Who was it, Eddie? Was it?
Eddie Boots, yeah.
Eddie, yeah. I thought it was Paul the Parrot. He hasn't been on yet, has he?
No, he's got a question later on.
I knew he wouldn't let us down. So, for Imprint, I don't really understand why that's dropped so much, because the last actual update sounded okay, and the house broker raised the forecasts. And yet it dropped. So I have no idea why that. I wondered if it might be because of US tariffs, but apparently it kind of drop ships. It's got a drop shipping model, apparently. And so it doesn't import directly from China, although I suppose its suppliers might import the blanks, you know, the white mugs that get personalized for the customers in bulk, you know, these pens you see at exhibitions that are printed with the company name. It's all sorts of stuff like that. Huge product range. I don't really understand. All I can say is, based on the forecasts, and it's got a nice clean balance sheet with net cash, I think 4imprint looks good value. So yeah, I'm sorry I can't. I just don't know why it's derated.
Yeah.
Do you know this one, Paul?
No, I don't know. I mean, all I would say is that it could well be that somebody's using it as an ATM. If it's an active fund manager who needs to actually, you know, pay for some fund redemptions, then they're just using it because it's a big liquid stock and they can actually, you know, monetize it. And given that it's had a bit of a sort of like, it's a bit of a soggy market at the moment, then you only need a bit of sales, even from a 1.2 billion pound stock is going to drop it down. So it could just be a bit of technical selling. I really don't know either.
I think we're seeing a lot of that, aren't we? And I noticed some of the fund managers have started reporting asset under management this week, and there's not really any sign of redemptions drying up. I think it was Impax, I think, where it saw something like 8% drop in assets under management under in the most recent quarter. That was the one that lost to St. James's Place mandate, I think. Or is that the right company? I can't remember if it was Impax or another one. But I'm worried about the, as you quite rightly say, liquidity-driven selling, because it only seems to be in some stocks, doesn't it? It's almost random. Very strange market at the moment. Very difficult to work out what the hell's going on. So I sympathise with all the readers on that.
Same. You get battle every day. Okay, we've got one from a new joiner as well. Luke B. It's Luke Beer. He says. Anyway, any thoughts on? I think it's Greatland Gold. Is it? Is it GGP at all? I think they basically.
I can't say. Anything with the word energy, gold, or mining or resource sources in the name, I won't know a damn thing about them because I just don't cover that sector, I'm afraid. So is it one you know, Paul?
It isn't. Let me just put the chart on. I don't know it in detail, but I think it's basically a gold producer it's off Australia or South America, and I can't remember which one it is. I'm pretty sure it's Australia, but
Greatland.
I could be wrong.
Yeah, I've heard the name.
But I mean, all I would say is the only top level I know in terms of the gold, because obviously this is driven by gold price, is that there's been lots of central bank buying to de-dollarize. So essentially, you've got the likes of Russia, China heavily going into gold to have actually, you know, assets, but not be sort of like at the beck and call of the Federal Reserve that their assets can get suddenly frozen. So you've had a lot of central bank buying of late. And then you've also got. There's also certain countries as well who have been, I think they've got a lot of Chinese actually, not even just the central banks, but individuals in China who can't actually get their money out of the country, and they can't buy property.
Yes.
And they can't buy property because it's all going down. So the best way, instead of putting it under the bed, is to buy a whole chunk of gold, you know, so like a cougar angle or something like that. If they can get it.
Interesting.
And then you've got crazy things going off in the States whereby you have, I think, is it? There's one of the big sort of like not Walmart, but I'm just trying to Costco. They're actually selling gold to individuals.
Really?
So it's one like a bit like the Bitcoin craze. So all I would say is that there is a firm bid under the gold price. It looks cheap, Greatland Gold, but I don't really know that much about it, in great detail. But I'll just say in gold, you can understand why the price is going up. Okay, let's move on.
Just on that, I just want to emphasize, I'm not saying I think resources stocks are bad in any way. I'm just saying that I don't personally invest in them because I don't have any edge. I don't have any expertise. So that's the only reason why.
Yeah. Okay, well, we've got a question from yours and truly, Paul the Parrot. He's asking about cracking. He says, a cracking trading update from Impario today. Any thoughts on that, Paul?
Yes, I've written up quite a detailed section on that today. It was a very good update, in fact, for calendar 2024. This is a niche speciality animal feeds business that I've criticized in the past for having little to no organic growth. But its update today really put that to bed. It's delivered very nice growth. It also seems to have made a good acquisition near the end of the year in 2024. And the broker, which I think was, I can't remember now, might have been Panmure Liberum, they've raised the earnings per share forecast for 2024 by 20%. Now, that is a big increase, isn't it, to happen when the year's actually already completed. So they've obviously, that certainly makes me sit up and look. I like it a lot, but as I did point out today, something I only discovered today, actually, it's spent an awful lot of the company's own cash on buying shares for the Employee Share Ownership Trust. And the Employee Share Ownership Trust is now the biggest shareholder and owns 18%. Now, you might think that's good. Oh, the staff own the business. But in my experience, these share ownership trusts are nearly always in favor of the directors, almost exclusively. And it's hidden remuneration because none of the cost goes through the P&L. It's accounted for, and this is perfectly legit, perfectly legal, it's accounted for as a negative reserve on the balance sheet, which is outrageous. So basically, they've spent 10 or 11 million pounds buying free shares for the directors over a long period of time, and none of that cost has been reflected through EPS or profit, which is actually quite scandalous. You saw a similar thing at Reynolds last year that I flagged up, and the way you spot these employee share trusts and the money leaking out is through the cash flow statement. So that's where you always need to look at the last 2 years' cash flow statements. And if you find substantial purchases of employee share ownership trust shares, then you've just found basically where management have got their hands in the till. So does that actually matter with Anpario? I think it does a bit, yes. It's a shame because in all other respects, I really like this share and I turned green on it last September. But I do want to flag up the employee share ownership leaking of millions of pounds out to give free shares to management, just so that people are aware. And once people are aware, they can make up their own mind on it. You know, I'm not coming to a conclusion about this. I'm just flagging the facts for people.
Mm. No, it's a shame.
Very easy to miss. You see, I don't think I picked up on this until about a year or two ago, and I've been investing for 25 years.
Yeah. No, it's a shame because the business really does seem to be sort of taking off. But traditional way, I mean, as Warren Buffett does it anyway, is actually include the share-based payments line in the P&L, which is there anyway to cover share-based payments. So, but obviously the adjusted numbers, most of them are always, you know, before share-based payments.
Yeah, no, you're right. But this is in addition to share-based payments. This is undisclosed. The share ownership trusts do not go through the P&L at all. It goes through reserves. It goes through reserves on the balance sheet. Yeah. So this is in addition to LTIPs, and it's hidden.
Well, yeah, I think the share-based payments is just a hypothetical charge which is put through as a provision through the P&L.
But that doesn't cover the share ownership trust. That's my point. It's totally separate.
It's supposed to cover all that share.
It won't. It won't cover the employment trust figures because they go through the balance sheet.
Not the payments, not the physical cash. It's supposed to be a sort of like a provision to cover the cost of future payments.
But it doesn't touch the P&L. That's what I'm saying, Paul. These are
no, it doesn't. No, I would agree. Yeah.
Share-based payments charge does go through the P&L, but the employee benefit trust figures don't touch the P&L at all. So it's over and above LTIPs. That's why hardly anyone knows about this, but it's real.
Yeah. No, you're right. It's definitely a real cost. It's cash going out of the business. Absolutely agree. Mm. Okay, good. Let's move to another one who came out with good numbers or an update. Was Clarkson, the shipping company, today. I don't know if you have a look at this one. I think it's got a bit of a similar problem with the employees, but they are dealers, obviously, you know, for doing obviously all the shipping and marine transport over the seas and stuff. How are you seeing this one?
even 100 times worse than the situation at Ampario. It's terrible. And again, I wrote up all the figures on this today, revisited them from an article I've written for Stockopedia last year. Yeah. This is outrageous. If you look at the detail on Clarkson numbers, in 2023, the director's remuneration, this is purely salaries plus bonuses, not the LTIPs, not the employee share ownership plans either, was exactly the same, £27 million the board paid themselves. And that was the same as the dividends paid to shareholders, £28 million. So on top of that, the staff bonuses accounted for nearly all of the £270 million cash pile. If you look in the creditors, the accrued staff bonuses figure is over about £230 million. It's unbelievable. So basically, I think shareholders are absolutely being taken for mugs here. All they get is a 2.5% dividend yield, and the staff and the directors take everything else for themselves. It's outrageous. So no, it's a good company. This is the thing. And nobody cares about employee benefits if the shares are going up, and it has, you know, since 2008, it's 12 bagged. So I can understand people being docile, but honestly, look at the numbers and the amount that management, this company is run almost entirely for the benefit of its staff and management, with shareholders getting a 2.5% yield. It's ridiculous.
Well, it's a people business.
Yeah, even so. Yeah, they take things to extremes that I don't think I've ever seen anywhere else. It's unbelievable. All I'd say, people, is make your own mind up. Look in the annual report, look at the notes of the accounts, and you can see the numbers, and you won't believe them. They're absolutely staggering.
Yeah, well, I wish you and I were working for that company. Okay, we've got a question coming in from Harish Haran. He's asking about Dot Digital, which I don't know that much about. Yes. I don't know if you've ever come across it at all.
I've covered it for many, many years. Good company, very cash generative, plenty of cash on the balance sheet. It does digital marketing software, cloud-based, I think. it's a good business, high margin, as I say, generates lots of cash. The main problem with it is that it really struggles to generate any organic growth. The growth all comes from charging existing companies more. So it seems to be the case that they've got a very big user base that love the product, and they can keep charging more and maybe have more seats, more desks added to the license and so on. But it hasn't demonstrated for quite a few years now that it can generate any organic growth at all in actual client numbers, you know. So that is the big point really to look into in this. If it gets to a point where suddenly, you know, the growth accelerates, then you could be onto a bonanza here. But that is the key issue with it, I think.
What does the software do? It helps marketing and AI and stuff like
email,
that.
Yeah, it's email marketing basically. It creates templates, and I mean, it sounds a little bit old hat, I have to say. But so whether AI will make this redundant, who knows?
No, you're exactly right. That was the point I was thinking about, because you're going to get software companies which are massive beneficiaries of AI, who can incorporate all the obviously the outside databases and the company's databases to really improve the product for the client, and will also be used. The AI will reduce their costs, and you get other companies actually which could be disintermediated by AI, and therefore it's a really good point, because you could see the Microsoft Copilot actually being, you know, run as an automation tool to change, you know, to actually, you know, disintermediate companies like this. There's another one actually. Yeah. I don't know if you've ever come across it, called Get Busy at all, which I think it's an automation company that does, it's basically for financial companies and accountants. Mm. It helps you with tax and document management and stuff like that. And it's struggled. I'll just put it on the screen, actually.
It's an Australian minnow, and it's got a legacy business. I think it's called something Vault, which...
Yes, it is.
Generates the cash, which they then spend on two Blue Sky projects. So quite an interesting sum of the parts thing, if the Blue Sky projects work, I think. But is it Smart Vault? Something like that.
Yes, it is. It's Smart Vault. Yeah, well remembered, yeah.
That to me looks maybe a bit legacy-ish. So I've never got completely comfortable with Get Busy.
A good sign, actually, that, you know, there may be growth may be slowing up is actually just look at that top line, because the similar sort of thing, I think, with Dot Digital and Get Busy is actually it's plateaued some of the revenue and you're only just seeing it through pricing. And they I think Get Busy trades at about sort of 1 or 1.5 times sales, which is pretty cheap but given it's got 90% recurring revenue streams, it's really cheap for a software company. But I think the market is worried, as you rightly point out, about the potential disintermediation of just simple co-pilot type applications coming onto the market, allowing professionals to do what that software has done. But I could be wrong anyway.
Yeah, it looks a bit legacy-ish to me. So I've not. And the trouble with all these blue sky projects, they're all very well, but as you know, they take much, much longer and cost much, much more to get off the ground, if they get off the ground at all, don't they? So I tend to value blue sky type stuff in most companies at pretty much zero.
Yeah. Okay, let's go back to sort of like a smaller retailer. We've got Topps Tiles, who came out with a trading update, I think, this week. They basically do all things tiles in the UK for bathrooms and kitchens and everything else. How are you seeing this one?
Well, I might end up looking a fool here, but I think it's possible that there might be some teeny weeny little green shoots here. Started to show, or at least things don't seem to be getting any worse. Anyway, I think it just reported the most recent quarter, and I think they said it was positive like for likes or an improving trend within the quarter, something like that. But what they didn't tell us in the RNS, which the broker very kindly did, they were up against very soft prior year comparatives where it was minus 7%. So they haven't recouped that in full. So on a 2-year view, sales are still dropping. Even, and remember, company accounts don't take into account inflation. So, you know, you need over a 2-year period, you need sales up 10 or 15% just to offset general cost inflation. So I'm certainly not, leaping out and filling my boots with Topps Tiles, but I do wonder if it might be at or near the low. And as the broker note, I mean, these broker notes are so helpful. I'm really greatly indebted to the analysts who put a lot of work into these things. I know, yes, they're biased and all the rest of it, but for information gathering, they're incredibly helpful. And the broker at Topps Tiles basically said, you've got operational gearing with this. When a recovery in the tiling market, which is linked to obviously the housing market, when that happens, you've got a largely fixed cost base at Topps with all these sheds, retail sheds. You could get a nicely operationally geared effect on the bottom line, such that it's not entirely outrageous to suggest that the low level of profits currently could double in a year or two's time. So I think Topps Tiles, I think it's worth people having a look at least. Its balance sheet doesn't have anything much on it. It's slightly negative net tangible asset value, but it actually doesn't have structural bank debt. It's like a lot of retailers, it's actually financed by the trade creditors.
It's only trading about 10.5 times PE. So,
trouble is at the low point of the cycle when the profits are, can jump around so much, PE is not terribly helpful at this stage, I would say. Also, bear in mind the dividend yield Topps is optically very, very good. But given that it has slightly negative net tangible asset value and its profits are quite unpredictable at the moment, I wouldn't hang my hat on the divvies. Some companies you can look at, they've got so much cash in the bank, you're going to get your divvies regardless, aren't you? Well, this isn't one of them. So I would put, a 50% risk maybe on the divvies being cut or even passed altogether. And some of the building supplies companies now are saying, no recovery till mid-25 at the earliest, could even be 2026.
I think it'll be slightly earlier than that, but you take a punt. I mean, I was just pointing out the PE of sort of 10 was low because you're on low or hopefully trough earnings, and therefore if you do get a doubling of your PE, then it's going to look super cheap at 5 times.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. We've been through quite a few economic cycles, you and I, and often, when you find things at the bottom of the stock market and the bottom of the cycle, earnings, you look back later and you find out that actually profit was 2 or 3 times what people thought it was going to be, and you think, why on earth weren't we loading our hatchback up to the roof with these things,
so
you and I have all works, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you and I already have, haven't we? That's we certainly haven't been short and loaded up. We're fully loaded in the
Are you fully invested now, Paul, or are you still got some cash?
I've got some cash coming, but at the moment I'm fully invested. Yeah, I haven't sold my
Equals. Of course, you've got a whacking great windfall from Equals coming in, haven't you?
I've got a big chunk. Yeah, that'll probably come in April or May time, and then I've got some bonds maturing in May as well. So that'll boost it up to about. I've got about sort of 25% cash coming in. So yeah. I'm going spend my Christmas in spring, I think, this year.
Yeah.
Okay. Awesome. We got a question coming from Lemon Physical. He's asking about Pinewood Technologies, which is the old software company, dealership software for cars, spun out of Pendragon. And I know Christopher Mills was a real big fan and pointed out to everybody, and I didn't follow. I was a bit daft. But anyway, I think the shares have done pretty well. I don't know if you've had a look at this one.
I have. I'm not generally keen on these divestment type scenarios, but to be fair to them, this one's worked brilliantly. The concept being that buried within a low PE car dealer was this fabulous software business, and that if it was divested, it could then sell to all their competitors because there'd be no longer be competitors. It seems to work to treat, doesn't it? I'm just refreshing my memory. Forward PE on Pinewood now is 24 times, so a bit pricey, but not outrageous for a growing software business. I think people are saying that the growth there is very, likely to be very good. And I think it's growing through a strategic partner in America as well, isn't it? So yes. I think this looks a very interesting company, yeah. And if the Harwood boys are on it, it's definitely an interesting company.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think they've got a joint, you're right. It's that joint venture in the States with a car dealership, a big US car dealership, who's basically going to implement their software across the whole of the States, and therefore they've underpinned all. They've got huge visibility over their earnings for the next 4 or 5 years because it's just rollout. And then it's the upside, the jam extra, or the cherry on the top, is if they win any other third party dealerships. And I think they won one actually in the UK not recently. So it isn't cheap, but I would say it's a really high quality stock that if you ever see weakness on it, which I don't. Oh yeah, Lemon Physical says the company is Lithia, which was the joint venture.
That's it, Lithia. Yeah. Yes, I remember now. Yeah, no, I agree completely. I love to see software companies like that have, like you say, you've just described, some big catalyst for why they can gain market share. And no, that sounds great. What we need to do is find somebody who uses this software and buy them a couple of drinks down at the Mary Shelley and find out what they actually think of it. You know, what's it like, the user experience? Because I think I've often found with software companies that could be quite valuable. Hearing about, I've heard some stories of absolutely shambolic software, and I've steered clear of the shares in the dim and distant past. Yeah.
Yeah, there's quite a lot of M&A in that dealership software industry as well, because there's a well-known competitor out in the States, and I can't remember what it's called, but it trades at about 15 to 20 times sales. It's
good
growing.
Like,
it's, exactly. These things are really growing because it's sort of like so much digital improvement that the dealerships can get the benefits. And I know Pinewood trades at probably around about 4 or 5 times sales, but it's only a third of its actual competitors, but it's high margin. So really good.
I'm not keen on price to sales, because to me it's margins are so important. You know, it could be cheaper, it could be really expensive. If it's not making a drop of profit, then price to sales doesn't matter to me. So I'm yet to be convinced that price to sell, but it doesn't matter what I think, the market uses it. So I'll have to learn to
the advantage of using one metric like price to sales, if you can use a whole sort of like a bunch of metrics, but one of them the sales is that then you get an idea of the private valuation of the business. That's why people do it. It gives, because if you don't know the upside, then you don't know how to really sort of like look at the probability based net value of the company.
I think that's right, but I would add just a slight caution point on that. When I hear some of these fund managers talking about these recovery and margin improvement stories, they seem to me to be terribly blasé about, it'll get, like, say, Capita. Oh, it'll get back to 6 or 7% operating margins. Well, it hasn't achieved anything like that for years. So why do you just think the margins are going to go like that to that? So I think quite often the disappointment comes from the margin improvement not actually happening. But
good. Another company that is super high quality along the lines of sort of Pinewood that I just like to highlight to investors. I don't own and have no relationship with the company at all, but yes. Is Big Tech, which is basically an expert in prisoner electronic tagging.
Yeah,
now,
it's interesting.
This company basically listed in 2021, mid-2021, for about two quid, I think, and then went up to about three or four. It was a bit of a dialing. But basically what it does is custodial or judicial sort of, you know, prisoner tracking devices, the ankle trackers, et cetera. But the secular tailwinds in the business or in that industry is obviously there's an urgent need for reliable and accurate home detention and tracking, for, like curfew management and stuff, to alleviate prison overcrowding. And tracking reduces the cost of having somebody at home rather than in prison by about 85%. So it all hits the right buttons, no doubt about it. Now, they've got this buddy smart tech that does all the movements for prisoners whilst they're at home, et cetera. And it's got a lot of sort of like benefits in terms of its functional performance of the actual. It works off for sort of like GPS and cellular tracking, but also can work off for sort of like a home beacon as well. So it's really super accurate. And it's got all the data associated to it. And one of the big advantages of that, it reduces the amount of false alerts for the custodial service. So for the probation officers, if somebody hits the tracker, for instance, and then it puts out an alert, they don't want the probation officer going out needlessly to check whether the guy is. So that's obviously good. Now, what's also nice about regulated industries in prisons and stuff, it's basically largely recession proof. Because obviously, if anything, it's counter-cyclical. And it's really high barriers to entry, long-term contracts, 94% recurring revenues, 50-odd% EBITDA margins and 70% gross margins. So you get huge economies of scale. It's got a huge position out in Australasia. But now that on the downside, it lost a big contract in Colombia, which I think was for it was a local provider. And I think that was a political decision. It's long sales cycles. But the reason why I mention this is such that the shares have fallen. Yeah. Mm. And the question really comes down to is basically, has it gone X growth and is there tougher competition coming? You know, but on the positive side, you could get it such that the trackers are used by somebody like Trump to track all illegal immigrants coming, but actually, because he wants to get rid of 11 million people in the US. Now, he isn't going to be able to do that overnight, and he isn't going to be able to put them into prison. So you could see it that tracking and they're growing in the States is used or tagging for, you know, illegal immigration to control it in the States. And they do also have a pipeline of 50 big opportunities over the next 2 years, which could double their turnover, because their turnover is currently roughly around about sort of 50 million, etc. Their presence, they're big here in Australasia, which is I think 60% of about 60% of their revenues, 15% in Europe, and about 25% in the Americas. But they're trying to get federal and state contracts, custodial contracts there. And as I say, the upside of it to me is that it still isn't, doesn't look massively, sort of cheap still in terms of if you're just looking at on a, it's 19 times PE, 5.5 times Rebel 8 and about 11 times EBITDA. But it is massively cheap if you compare it against something which looks a bit like it, which is like Exxon Enterprises, which is the Taser manufacturer, and that trades at 16 times revs and 65 times EBITDA. And this is it's almost like a trophy asset. So the reason why I'd like to just mention it to investors, I think this is a really, really high quality company trading at a sort of like, when you look at it as a private public valuation, trading at a reasonable valuation. And it's something to put on your stock watch list. As if anybody chunks out and drops this one down, this is something it is a very, very high quality company. I don't know if you've ever looked at it. It's got a huge cash balance as well.
I have. I've looked at it quite a few times, actually. I really like the business. I think it's an extremely high net profit margin it makes, which, of course, does attract a lot of competition. But it also tells you they've got something, you know, that is a really leading product. And the founder, I think Sarah Murray, owns 27% still.
Yes.
So not going to get bid for unless she agrees the price, which actually can be quite good. The main reason I haven't bought any is it's just too unpredictable. It's too large, lumpy contracts.
Yeah.
A broker forecast has been steadily declining for about the last 18 months. So I just don't know how to value it. That's my main reservation with big technology, but I think it's a very interesting company for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're right. I mean, certainly when it comes to sort of customer concentration or contract concentration, if I remember right, I think I put it in here. Basically, there's about three customers account for like 50% of the sales. So it's this big deals. But if you win one, then it moves the dial significantly. But anyway, something to stick on the stopwatch.
Yeah, it's good stock idea for the watch list. Definitely, yeah, I like that.
Okay, on the other end of the sort of the valuations spectrum, super cheap is H&T, which came out, which is basically the UK's biggest pawnbroker. How do you see this one? Because it must be a point when it becomes good value, because last time I looked at it, it was at about 6.5 times PE.
Yeah, I don't understand this one at all. We always talk about this. My colleague Dave covered it this week. I think there was a trading update, which I think off the top of my head was in line. I think that's right.
Yes.
Or thereabouts. Yeah, forward PE, 6.5 times. Great divvies, 5.5%. And it's only a whisker over price to tangible book. So you're fully asset backed. Sort of playing devil's advocate, when Dave wrote this section, I was sort of challenging it and editing it. I said to him, well, look, what if the pledge book and the inventories are massively overstated? You know, and that really is the main risk, I think. You know, there could be a whole huge heap of bad debts not properly calculated in the loan book. But there again, as he pointed out, well, they're asset-backed loans. If the customer defaults, which lots of them do, you sell their Rolex or their, and you've given them a loan that's well within the price of the... They're doing a lot more larger loans now, aren't they? 5K plus. But even if the odd one of those goes wrong, you know, you'd still be... it wouldn't move the dial for the whole company. I think, you know, look, the numbers, it looks dirt cheap, and it's the UK's biggest pawnbroker. They're opening more sites. Yeah, I don't understand the valuation, but it's been cheap for years. So are you of a similar mind, Paul?
Yeah, I am. I think it's just dead cheap. I don't own the shares, but I just can't understand why it's such good value, other than is there some sort of digital sort of like service by somebody else who's actually going to sort of disintermediate it, but you don't need shops. But yeah, no, it looks crazily cheap, no doubt about it.
The only other thing I thought about, but you know, just bouncing ideas around for potential risk, is you're getting so many legal claims now cropping up in all sorts of sectors, like the car dealer financing thing that's almost bankrupted Close Brothers and Secure Trust Bank. You've got the big retailers now facing the paid sex discrimination thing. You legal claims seem to pop up now with increasing regularity, and in areas that previously we wouldn't have thought of as being risky. So I don't know. I think pawnbroking's been investigated before by regulators, hasn't it? And they generally took the view this is secured lending, so people can't default on it. They just lose their watch or whatever. And they'll just go to loan sharks if this service was not available. So I think regulators in the past have actually said, look, you know, better the devil we know type of thing. But of course, that could change, couldn't it?
Yeah. And I think actually one morning we'll wake up, both of us will wake up, and you'll have a private equity who will put a bid on these, and it will go for, you know, sort of double the price because it's just such good value and it's cash generative. You just see somebody decide to pick it up.
It's possible, I suppose, but they all seem transfixed with tech, don't they, and AI. You don't really see many bids coming in for value-type companies. I can't think of any recently, anyway.
Well, you saw DBay this morning buying Alliance Pharma. I mean, they bought it at about 10 times EBITDA to take it off the market. I mean, what's quite interesting read across, just if we're looking at other potential takeovers. I mean, I would say to anybody, if you've got any ideas of takeover opportunities, put them into the chat bot and we can all have a good look at it. But I would, but also one which is related to Alliance Pharma that I highlighted to you last week is Venture Life, because it's pretty much a similar sort of business, you know, consumer products. And they took D-Bay took Alliance Pharma out at 10 times EBITDA. And I think from memory, Venture Life trades about 5.5 times EBITDA. So, you know, when you look at it on a multiple basis, there's going to be lots of arbitrage. We're just going to see it. We probably both agree on this. If prices for small and micro caps stay at current levels, we're going to see a continued deluge of M&A because they're just getting picked off.
I agree. I think it's more the mid caps that seem to attract those type of bids, doesn't it? I think with Venture Life, I'll keep an open mind, but I think it's largely unproven at this stage. But yeah, I'm happy to. I'll cover their updates when they come out, and happy to change my mind. Yeah.
Yeah. Another one on the takeover sort of train is coming. Question from Varun Kapoor. He's asking about Team Internet, which is that marketing business, I think. What's your view on this one?
I think it's a horrible business, actually. I've never understood why people would want to buy that. Then I was going to mention that one. It was it announced on this Tuesday, actually. Mm. It had two takeover approaches, both at £1.25 from, the names escape me now. But anyway.
Towerbrook was one, wasn't it?
The other one was called Verdana, I think, or something like that, Verdana. Yeah. Anyway, here we are 3 days later, and Towerbrook actually issued a Rule 2.8 announcement saying no intention to bid. That is very peculiar, isn't it? Coming just 3 days after, but unfortunately it didn't give any explanation whatsoever, which again is fairly normal, isn't it? You just get a dry takeover panel announcement saying we're not going to bid. We have no idea why. So, and unfortunately it's given back about half of that spike up that we had on Tuesday. So I hope people took some profits on Tuesday and Wednesday, because, you know, a lot of these bid approaches do fall through, don't they?
Yeah, no, they can do, particularly for the private equity. I think the reason why Towerbrook has dropped out is simply because it doesn't want to start having a bidding auction for an asset when it's got other things on it. I mean, it's buying Equals, so for instance, it's got plenty on its plate. But I don't think private equity like to get into bidding, against each other. All they do is push the price up. We got one coming up from another one coming in on Van L, which is basically the equipment hire business that does piling in the UK. And the comment is saying that Harwood's been buying, which is quite interesting, actually, because this is the super smart investors out in, Christopher Mills, that their team. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't got my latest notes to hand, but just looking at the core numbers, I know, I'm broadly positive on this one, I think, thinking back to previous reports. Forward PE 7.4, dividend yield 4%, and it trades below net tangible asset value. So that's a nice start, isn't it? Numbers like that. Yeah. This is a nice place to. So yeah, I would say, can't remember the latest detail on it, and it could be a sort of bottom of the cycle type thing, couldn't it? If it's doing the piling for construction and ground engineering. Yes. So yeah, I think that one. You know what I'm like. I normally have a pretty scathing reason not to go into things. So I think this one, potentially interesting.
Well, and also I think, you mentioned that you might only start selling building products coming into sort of like seeing the upswing towards the back end of this year or next year even.
Yes.
But these guys at the front of the curve, aren't they? Because they actually put the footings into buildings and stuff like that. So if anything, these guys will see that much faster. And also I think they've got a sort of like a beachhead out in Canada, if I remember rightly, as well. They're going to do the same. So, yeah, it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, and here's an interesting point as well. Harwood have got 8.3%, and they added on the 6th of January this year. And also, NR Holdings Limited has got 5.6%. Now, that is Nat Rothschild, the chairman of Lord Rothschild, who's the chairman of Volex. So that's interesting that he's popped up there, because he's no fool. So Van L, I think it'd be worth people spending a bit of time looking at it, and let us know what you think.
I would agree. Okay, we've got another one coming in on what was the one I was going to look at? I'll just get my thoughts. Oh crikey, Which one? Philtronic. Yeah, that's it. Philtronic.
Oh, yes.
The latest, latest views on. We've got a couple of people asking about Philtronic, which is obviously the business that's doing really well out of providing wireless communication devices into Elon Musk's SpaceX business.
Yes, I like this one. I mean, I can't value it. I don't know how to value it because it all depends, again, large lumpy orders, single products, single main client risk and all that. I think we've talked about this last week or the week before. So I can only go on a hunch. I think this looks quite exciting, actually. Yeah.
Any ones which you'd guess is going to do the same as Philtronic this year at all?
No idea.
No idea. Okay.
All we can do is monitor the trading updates and the contract win announcements for the whole market, and just occasionally you spot something where something big is changing. But you know, if I spot one or two of those in a year, I've done well. So But I missed Philtronic. It was really frustrating when I spotted it. It was, you know, the main move had happened.
Yeah. Okay. We've got Fistafile, I think his name is. Anyway, if I could pronounce it correctly. He's asking about Foresight Group, which I think is a fund manager, is it, or something? Is that correct?
Oh, yes. Yes. I looked at that this week. I should be careful what I say here, so I don't want to get sued.
Not positive then.
On a desktop review of the numbers, I thought this looked very good. That was, I think, on Wednesday's report on my Substack. But then the readers starting adding comments saying that some of them claim to have had dealings with Foresight Group and were, shall we just say, less than complimentary about them. So I can't obviously endorse those comments because they're just put up by my readers on the internet, but I've got no reason to doubt anything they said. So that, I think, makes me a bit cautious, but it did say in its update that Foresight Group, it's a specialist fund management group, it expects to double profits by 2029, and it's only on a PE of 8.8 and a 7% dividend yield. So, you know, and its profit and revenue growth track record is very good. So, I mean, the numbers look attractive, but I'm told that the business itself and what it does and the way it does it may not be quite so attractive. So people need to verify that for themselves, I'd say.
Yeah, okay, good. Okay, we swap them. I know it top level, but there's so much to choose from in these sort of fund managers, isn't there, in terms of, you know, selection-wise. You've got to be very specific. And they look super, super cheap, but frankly, there's still outflows going into passives. And until that sort of starts, we saw that the last 4 years, was some figures which came out from one of those industry guys, and they were just saying the same, that it's basically the UK has been hit by the exodus to passives, or the shift to passives.
Yeah, it has. These guys, though, actually, in this week's update, they said that they're winning new significant amounts of new money, which is offsetting all the inflows. So I think at constant currency, its quarterly change in asset under management was flat. So. Yeah. This seems more positive than the others.
Yeah. Okay, good. We've got a question coming from Dan Scott Limtot. He's asking about React, which I think is a contract cleaning business that just, didn't they just buy somebody recently in plumbing or something like that? I can't remember the details, but share price has done pretty well.
It's quite interesting, this one, actually. They had that chicken and egg thing where the equity was very, very cheap, so they couldn't issue equity to acquisitions that they wanted to do. But they had a big burst upwards in share price, but it's given back about half of it, 20 million market cap. It'd be interesting. I think management seemed quite good at identifying takeover targets. And you think, cleaning, not very interesting. Actually, some of these cleaning companies, specialist ones, make big margins. So it's a proper profitable company. You'd need to check the balance sheet. I think it might have taken on quite a bit of debt for a recent acquisition. But I would say definitely worth having a closer look at.
Mm. I know there's some smart money in there. Christopher Isn't Mills there? Has talked about it. Yeah, this was like 3 or 4 years ago. Okay, good. Another sector that's battered, that's offering massive dividends, is the life assurers. And I've got Andy 2205 asking about, I know it's a big cap, but Legal & General, he says it's about 10% forecast yield, dividend yield.
Yeah, I don't trust the accounts of these big insurers. They're too opaque. So yeah, I don't have any view on any of them.
Mm. Yeah, I would say, you know, well, all I would say, let me put the chart up here. because I think it's definitely cheap. There's no doubt about it. I think they all are.
Yeah, like, the dividend yield is what you're going for here, isn't it? Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. I think what happens, unfortunately, is when you get a spike up in bond yields, then people get skittish because they look at the pension promises they've made going forward and whether it's their liabilities and all this sort of stuff. And I know they had a bit of a shakeout in terms of all that bond laddering they do in their balance sheet, etc., when they had a Liz Truss moment. So you're right, they're a bit black box type of investing, but one sensible investor, like I think Lord John Lee, he owns a shed load of these big life assurers because he loves the dividends out of it.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, the shares don't really seem to go anywhere. They've gone sideways for about the last 12 years, haven't they? Oscillated between £2 and £3. But of course, if you're collecting in a £10 dividend and the share's gone sideways, 10% dividend, sorry, then you're making a nice total return, aren't you?
Yeah.
But they're not for me, because I think, again, these balance sheets, you know, if you marked everything to market during the great financial crisis, these were all bust. It was only because they didn't mark to market that, you know, on the argument that they were going to hold all their bonds to maturity till expiry. For me, much too complicated. I wouldn't know where to start going through the numbers.
Yeah, and they would have all gone bust in that Liz Truss moment if the Bank of England had bailed them out as well, which was when
LDIs, was it?
That's it, LDIs. I was trying to remember what the word was. Yeah,
something or others. Yeah.
Yeah, I know that moment. Okay, we've got one last question from Ben Sharman. He's asking about REITs, because obviously quite a few of them are super, super cheap, whether it's supermarket REITs, any type of REITs, trading at discounts to net tangible assets. And they've got quite a good dividends. How are you seeing these?
Well, I've bought five of them recently, thinking these were the safest part of my portfolio, and I'm showing thumping great losses on all of them. So it's because they're just linked to long-term interest rate expectations. So they've taken a real whack in the last 2 or 3 months. But you're right. I mean, some of these are churning out fabulous dividends. So the five I've got, and I took some advice from a sector expert on these, Warehouse REIT, which is WHR. I like that because BlackRock are buying up lots of warehouses. It's the sort of last mile delivery warehouses. Rents are rising. It looks very nicely asset backed. I don't think there's any reason to think the assets are going down in value. They're probably going up in value. And it's a big discount to NAV, and you get a nice dividend yield. So Warehouse REIT is good, I think. Then I've got a social housing REIT, which is SOHO. I'm also in that one, and I'm about 7 or 8% underwater on that one. But that'll be covered by the divvies just in year one, you see. So I'm not that way. Labs I like, which is Life Science, which is LABS is the ticker. They convert properties into science labs, and it seems to be quite a nice lucrative area. Again, discount to NAV and nice yield. And then Aberdeen Standard Euro Logistics, which I think is ASLI, the ticker. That one is a more immediate wind-up situation. So hence the discount to NAV is less, but they're disposing of all the properties and you're going to get your money back quite quickly on that one this year. And finally, CLS Holdings is a bit higher risk, but that one is a huge discount to NAV. Mm. It owns German and UK modern office buildings. The vacancy rate is a bit high, and there was a going concern at material uncertainty, but I think I looked into the detail of that, and I don't think it's a worry. They just and also they can refinance a lot of their debt in euros, which is much cheaper for the German properties. So I think have a look at all of those, but obviously we need this bond crisis to pass, don't we, really? So I don't know how they'll pan out, really. Have you got any, Paul, REITs?
No, I haven't got any REITs. They're not sort of typical kind of stocks I go for, sort of property or these kind of stuff. But I would say there's a lot of consolidation.
Yes.
Two, I think you've got to be quite selective in it, where there's going to be, if the higher bond yields mean higher debt costs, then you can get wider NAV discounts, because if you've got real, you know, if you're a small REIT, then your cost of capital goes up. However, having said that, usually in their contracts, if the higher bond yields are a function of inflation, which is what's happening now in terms of, you know, expectations, then I think most of their contracts are inflation proofed, at least. You know, they're IPI plus, aren't they? There always are these things. They're over 10 years or 5 years. So actually REITs are very good for protecting against inflation. If you get a sort of hyperinflation or a strong inflation, then they just pass it on to their tenants as long as they stay there.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that makes sense, doesn't it? I suppose the key thing we need to try and find out is whether commercial property transactions are starting to dip down in terms of valuations. You know, if you get to a point where they are, then suddenly you might be looking at these REITs and saying, okay, because they all marked down their property values big time in 2022 and 23. But if there's another markdown needed, you know, and I always work on the basis that they've probably overstated the valuations by maybe 5 or 10%, you know, to be maybe more prudent, that's a good assumption to make. But if you've got another big leg down in valuations that's going to happen, then these things may not be cheap at all.
No, you're right. That's a really good point. Yeah, it's the cap rates, isn't it? Is they're actually valued in the balance sheet at, and they get revalued every single year. So you're right.
Yeah. But and you don't know how accurate those valuations are. And also, I mean, normally the debt, they have a certain number of maturities coming up each year. I mean, CLS Holdings looks high risk, but actually, as they say in the material uncertainty going concern warning, they say the debt facilities are siloed on individual or groups of properties with no recourse to the holding company. So the absolute worst case scenario, if they can't agree a refinance on a particular office block in Germany or something, they just give the keys to the lender. So which would never has never happened before. So if they, as they say, as management say in the commentary, we got through 2008 and 2009. Okay, so why do people think, you know, these problems would escalate out of control now when conditions are nothing like as bad as back then? So I think it's a risk worth taking on CLS Holdings, but it's not such a big amount that it would hurt my portfolio if it goes wrong. You know, the position sizing, I think, is important. And buying a basket of five of them in different activities. You know, I wouldn't have five REITs that are all office blocks. And of course, every day you read about big companies now demanding that all the staff come back into the office, don't you? So I think the vacancy rates on high quality offices could ease.
Yes, I think they definitely will. Yeah, I know. I would agree. Yeah. Just in total, how many stocks do you now hold then, Paul? I mean, not the individual ones, but just in across the whole patch.
Probably about 25 differing sizes. You know, I like to just buy a few of something, stick it in the portfolio. Then it's on my screen every day. And I think, I better check that one. And, you know, I think you do something similar, don't you?
Yeah. No, I tend to do 15 to 20. But if I could get 25 really great high conviction stocks, then I would own them as well. But anyway, we'll wait and see. Okay, well, brilliant. Well, thanks very much, everyone, for your questions. We'll have to wrap it up there. We've gone 10 minutes overdue. And if you've got any other questions, save them for next week, 3:00. A big thanks, obviously, to Paul. And have a great weekend, everyone. So thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. Thanks, everyone. Bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.